Welcome to On the Mark, a podcast series that explores the effects on various businesses and industries of the COVID pandemic. The previous series of podcasts explored it during the pandemic. Now we're exploring with this series the long-term effects and how companies are going to, in the future, adjust permanently and sometimes temporarily to the pandemic. I'm your host, Howard Mark Rubin, and this podcast series came as a result of my realization as an attorney for over 30 years representing different businesses and corporations that this pandemic was a generational change, that nothing will ever be the same, that technology and the pandemic put together made these changes permanent in most people's lives. It had such a diverse effect on industries and people who work in these industries that I wanted to explore how companies and people have adapted now that hopefully we're in a post-COVID world. Sponsoring this series of podcasts is the Strategic Forum, which was founded in 1999 in New York City and expanded in 2000 in Florida, South Florida. It is an organization consisting of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and business leaders who believe in forming deep business and personal relationships based on mutual respect and trust and continued learning and intellectual enrichment. Current membership in the Strategic Forum represents a diverse group from public and private businesses and organizations. We have some exciting guests exploring a different industry, if you want to call it an industry. We're talking today about COVID's effect, short-term and long-term, in charities, because charitable organizations are a business of sort, and they certainly have been affected greatly by the pandemic. Tonight, we're talking to two people who are involved with the Whaling Museum and Education Center of Cold Spring Harbor, a terrific landmark. And I call it a museum, but they call it an education center, I guess. Also, if you're in Long Island in the Cold Spring area, it's a wonderful place to visit, particularly with your kids. My kids love going there. And we have two people from the Whaling Museum, Anthony Scarponi, who's the president, and Nomi Dayan, who's the executive director and I guess runs the day-to-day operations and makes Anthony look good. Welcome to Great. On the Mark, both of you. How are we doing today?
Thanks. Great. Thanks very much, Alex.
Okay. So let me ask Nomi a question. How long have you been with the Whaling Museum? Were you there during the pandemic or you came after the pandemic?
Yes, I joined the museum in 2008, so that was well before the pandemic.
Okay, and during the pandemic, I guess like in 2020, March 2020, what was the biggest challenge you had? Was it more fundraising or was it more operations? What were the biggest challenge you faced?
Sure, that's a good question. So internally, like most museums, we operate on thin margins of financial sustainability, and we're largely dependent on revenue from community events, admissions, and memberships, and of course fundraising activities, which are crucial and support half of our operating budget. So when we had suspension of admission operation for months, and you know, the 4,000 school kids who come here every year, those school trips disappeared, and we had to cancel three key fundraisers. Financially, originally we thought it would be a very difficult year. Looking back, because of the different ways the museum was able to find support, the museum came out financially much stronger than previous years.
Wow.
So that was a positive silver lining. But when we were in it, it really took a remarkable amount of creativity and thinking outside the box and pivoting very quickly to adapt what the museum offers and keep the museum relevant and what we felt was essential for the community.
So, Anthony, what's your role in the museum? I know you actually have a full-time job outside of this, but I know you're very beloved in the museum, so I know you do a lot of good work there, and I know that you're very dedicated to them. So tell us about what your role is.
Well, I'm the board president of the Whaling Museum. I've been with the museum since 2018, so I've been there about 5 years. I started out as treasurer and then moved up to board president. I love the museum. I went there, like a lot of people in the Long Island area. I went there as a kid. My mom took me there. And during the 70s, you remember there was a big movement in whaling, save the whales. And as at the time I was in grammar school, we all got very much involved in that in school. So at the museum, really I'm giving guidance with respect to kind of the governance of the museum, the governance of the board, and also helping guide the financial direction and the fundraising for the museum. The great thing about the museum is the very flat sort of museum. The board and Nomi and the museum staff, we all work very much hand in hand, and we collaborate together. So it's been great to work there, because I can work directly with board members and work directly with the staff.
And Nomi, let me ask you, now I think that hopefully the pandemic is over. What long-term effects do you see in the operation of the museum? Did you adapt things during the pandemic that you were able to carry over, or are things going back to where they were pre-pandemic?
Right. It is different. We are returning to some, previous ways that we operated, but we are, we're a different museum. One of the things that we introduced were more virtual learning opportunities, and we're keeping that. And we do have some schools that prefer to do an online session with an educator here. We send the school Scrimshaw packets that the kids can do. We also send educators out to schools, so we're hitting the road more. If people and groups are unable to come here, our Museum to You program is growing. And we were lucky that we had the framework for our Museum to You program in place pre-COVID, so we had something very quickly to work with. But I see that every year it continues to grow and get stronger, particularly with schools. Something else that we introduced during COVID was self-guided learning. So families who would visit would get a scavenger hunt where they would go around the museum on their own pace and solve clues and create a craft on their own to take home. And that got very strong response, and we're still doing it, so that if you don't want to come to something that's led by a facilitator and you want to work at your own pace, we provide very open-ended learning opportunities. Like last month, you had to learn how to read signal flags, and there were different codes around the museum that would direct you where to go. Then you decorate your own flag to go home. This summer, we're doing shark invasion, where you look for shark themed clues and learned about shark biology at the museum. So that's something that has seen positive response and engagement from the community that we are continuing. We also were able to put more fuel towards capital projects at the museum that we continue to work towards and benefit from. So for an example, when the museum was closed down, we did make some gallery improvements. We rehoused our archives. Those are projects that we continue to work on. But our biggest capital project is our whale skeleton project, where we are conceptually designing a renovation and expansion project that's going to center a full-size whale skeleton. And being closed for COVID kind of gave us extra thinking time to really devote more time and energy to this project, which has been moving along slowly but surely. And so that's something that we're continuing past COVID, so that we can make bring this incredible project to fruition. We haven't publicly announced it yet, but we are very excited about it. And I think it would be this incredible space and symbol for Long Islanders as this permanent spot to learn about our amazing whaling heritage.
Are you expanding? Let me ask you this. Are you just whales? You mentioned sharks before. Are you expanding beyond just, not that whales aren't enough, but are you expanding beyond whales?
Right. So, you know, our title is the Whaling Museum, an education center, but the truth is we go beyond the subject of whaling. We are a humanities-based institution, so, you know, we have a wide range of permanent and changing exhibitions year-round, and we have wonderful programs. You might come for a program where we never even mention the word whale, but ties you back to the ocean, ties you back to our incredible history of being tied to the sea. So we, like I said, we do go beyond the subject. Our 6,000 item collection is tied to the whaling history of Long Island and particularly Cold Spring Harbor. But if to only talk strictly about whaling is to certainly doom the museum to die of irrelevance, because we, you know, that's one of our biggest challenges, is making whaling history matter and making it relevant. We don't see whaling on its own little island. It's a very complex topic biologically and socially and technologically. There's incredible entry points that get people connected with our collection and with Long Island's maritime heritage. So for an example, this summer we have a wonderful sea glass festival, which also came out of COVID, because Howard, I was standing there in our collection storage room, and we have these incredible glass bottles, and they're beautiful. And I was thinking, how do I make these matter? How do I make this interesting to people today to come and look at these old bottles? And we thought sea glass, which is a popular hobby for many Long Islanders. And when we hosted it, that was our first big event post-COVID, and we had almost 700 people come, which for us was more than double what our most previous successfully attended event was. And so, mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I think thinking creatively, thinking innovatively, think outside the box. Yes, we do whaling lectures. Yes, you carve scrimshaw and you can hear sea shanties, but the ocean is a complex place. Whaling is a complex topic. And that's something that I'm very proud of. And that as a small museum, I think our creativity here is one of our biggest assets.
Great. And Anthony, let me ask you about where you see, or where you'd like to see the museum be in, a 1 or 3 year time frame from now. What are the goals as president? I don't know how long your term is, but it may be indefinite. But but what would you like to see accomplished in the next, say, 1 to 3 years?
Well, relative to like the COVID experience, and it did change, of course, for everyone. It changed our perspective on the businesses we're in, our own personal, you know, relationship to work and our relationship to our families and how we spend our time. So the museum itself, and it's an experience that comes out of the work I was doing. You mentioned before, I work in marketing, particularly in the education technology sector and the medical technology sector. For the museum, one thing that COVID really forced us to look at, and it's the same thing in private business, was, you know, how are we going to reach people virtually, because we can't all get together in a room. I was marketing director at a test prep company, and suddenly, you know, you couldn't get kids together for an SAT in a big gym anymore. And that business went away, the business of tutoring kids for, like, let's say the SAT, and it went away very quickly, very, very quickly. The benefit, you know, how quickly COVID kind of spread through March of 2020. Suddenly there was no business anymore. So for the museum business, where we relied on a lot of people to come in through the door, and we're having face-to-face programs with the community, now we had to look at, and suddenly we're closing the doors, we had to look at the online component of the experience of the museum. And this is what Nomi was saying. We had some online programs prior to COVID, but it allowed us to really say, well, hey, you start to realize we can reach people in the community, and we can maybe even reach a larger group of people online. There's people interested in the museum from all over the world, because the interest in whales and the ocean and the environment is really a global issue. So in 3 to 5 years, like Nomi said, primarily, it's really improving the in-person experience. We want to expand the museum. We really want to we have this opportunity to bring this full-size whale skeleton into the museum. It would be the only permanently exhibited full-size whale skeleton in New York and the only one on Long Island. But also in 3 to 5 years, expand our expand our experience online so that whether it's another COVID or it's another downturn economically or any kind of risk, we can kind of mitigate the risk of an institution that relies heavily on in-person visitation. And now we can say, hey, you know, we have a lot of people from all over engaging with us, donating, supporting us. The museum has, for a very small museum, it has an excellent social media following. It has a great online presence. So I think for most businesses, COVID was a time to look at their digital business, which we've all been kind of putting off, and say, hey, we really have to accelerate what we're doing digitally, what we're doing online, because that's where the majority, that's where more and more people are finding their experiences, learning about things, and there are some people are more comfortable that way than they are with coming into a museum or coming into a business.
You know, I find it interesting. I would have assumed that during COVID, fundraising would have been much more difficult. I think Nomi mentioned that you actually did pretty well and were able to expand during that period of time. What do you attribute it to? Why do you think that people were more willing to participate and give during the time of COVID when you would have expected them to be pulling back on giving?
I'll give a short answer, then Noni can give a short answer. I think what we found, and Noni, you can tell me if this is what you saw too, was we really did find first of all, there was a outpouring of support from the community, people that had given previously, because they knew that we were a small museum. We depended on, we're not publicly funded. We're not like, we don't get funding from the state. We don't get funding from, you know, the local governments or the federal government. We get grants. But we're very much a part of the community, and I think there was a lot of sympathy and for us. So people were giving, people couldn't get out, and suddenly I think their sense of what they could do for to preserve a sense of normalcy in the community helped prompt more donations, helped prompt more fundraising. You know, with that enormous change that kind of seized all of us. It might be that people were looking at smaller things in the community and say, well, I don't want this to change. I don't want the museum, you know, everything's turned upside down, but that doesn't mean the museum needs to go under or this local business needs to go under, you know? So I think that's what helped us.
Nomi, do you agree with that?
Right. Yeah. No. So just to piggyback on what Anthony was saying, I absolutely think that a higher level was given of giving was seen because of, frankly, sympathy. When you do put yourself out there and you say, you know, our museum is in danger of closing, and you know, that gets people to really reflect on how the pandemic showed us that culture is as important to survive a pandemic as our medical interventions. Because why do we visit museums? At its core, we think about what it learns. What we go to museums to learn about what it means to be human, and when we engage with humanistic projects and initiatives, when you go to see art, when you're part of a program, it enriches your understanding of our experience of the world. So many organizations like the museum did see this, you know, outpouring of support when you realize how much something means to you when it's suddenly in danger of not being there anymore. Our museum also benefited from many emergency grants from government funding, which helped significantly. We were one of the few museums on Long Island to get emergency support from the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for the Humanities. And so that also very much helped the museum. Now, also, Anthony did mention that pivoting to a digital presence was very important. But I also think that during the pandemic, when you couldn't physically come to the museum, you realize that when you go to a museum, you go for authenticity. You go to see the real thing in front of you and to be in presence of this amazing object. That experience has power. And, you know, you can see most of our collection online. You can see it on your phone. You can see it in your pajamas in the middle of the night when you're bored in bed scrolling. But I think when you realize that when you can't come and physically be in the presence of something, you realize that that's an incredible learning experience. So I'd like to think that that was part of people's incentive to be a museum supporter and see our community value.
So it seems that the community, if I'm if I'm understanding right, the community kind of coerced, got together and decided to support its institutions and look beyond its own personal struggles, which shows a lot of good in humanity and how they want to reach out and help in times of facing their own troubles. That's a very optimistic kind of a message for people, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, I think that also, like Nomi was saying, we, you know, Howard, you know, we started our golf outing 2 years ago, which has become a really backbone of the fundraiser for us. Because prior to that, our fundraiser was we would do a gala event with people and kids, very local, very provincial. We had to think differently about how we were going to raise money. And without people getting together for that gala event, we did have those 2 years where it was really tenuous. I tell you, we were surprised at sort of the local outpouring. It was great to see. I think Nomi's right. Nomi always quotes this great survey. It says, why do people go to museums? Do you remember that survey you quote? It's like, what's the number one reason people go to museums?
You know,
so, I know there's many surveys that it was to spend time together, right?
Yes, that's true.
The emphasis really is on, I go to a museum, it's like a third place, like maybe there's many, many places like this. I go to a restaurant for the food, but I really go to a restaurant to spend time with my family. I go to this museum because I'm definitely interested in these things. But the sense of togetherness, I told you at the beginning of the podcast, I had a very, you know, a lot of people were introduced to, particularly to our museum, and this might be for smaller museums, as children. I went there as a child. I brought my own, my daughter there, my wife and I brought our daughter there. You know, so it's been part of our growing up. It's been a very intimate part of our family. And I think that really is why people do have such a deep connection with it. If you're around long enough, and you have a varied amount of programs, like children's programs, for example, and adult programs. We have patrons like of all levels. So people have, you know, a broad range of experiences with us. And in a time of crisis, we happen to be one of the places that people thought of and said, hey, I don't want this to go under. I don't want this to change. And I can't help schools closing, and I can't do anything about businesses closing and layoffs and things like that. But what are the small things that I can affect locally? Like, that's why you saw. So I think that's also why you saw so much patronage to local businesses, especially out here in Huntington, the Huntington and Cold Spring Harbor area, where you have a lot of restaurants. Strong patronage to small museums and small businesses, especially restaurants, to keep those people going. So.
And do you see that continuing? Do you see that continuing now that we're in a post-COVID world, that people are still as engaged with the museum and possibly increasing their amount of giving or their interactions, adding the virtual to the digital, virtual to the in person?
Well, I think it got us thinking. Nomi, who's like more in touch with the day-to-day in terms of what's being given. I will say this, I mentioned the golf outing before. It got us thinking, not just thinking about, but taking action to reach a different group of people that we may not have thought of before, to try different kind of fundraising that we didn't try before. So we are seeing an increase in terms of the fundraising we're doing. That's in part because we've been kind of spurred into action and kind of sort of had to accelerate how we raise money. On the digital side of it, I think it's something all businesses and museums probably work with. It's like, well, how do we've got all this great traffic. We've got this great interest. We saw a big bump during COVID because more people were getting online. If you looked at the analytics from our site, which sounds very boring and wonky, and it is. But if you look at it, you see it had a great deal of visitation. It was spiking, obviously, during COVID. So how do we monetize? Can we monetize that virtual traffic? Can we monetize people who are showing an interest in experiencing the museum virtually from different parts of the country, different parts of the world? And can that help us stay, number one, solvent, but can it help us stay relevant and can it help us grow? So we became more tuned into these things because we had to. I think it'll probably, Howard, I think things will level out like the way they always do. So it'll be kind of a little bit of a new normal, but I think it'll kind of like find its level again. But we're tapped into or plugged into more ways to reach people and get more creative about fundraising and not take it for granted that doors will always be open. And if there's any kind of disruption, like Hurricane Sandy, it's only going to last a week or 10 days, but there could potentially be something that closes your, you know, closes your doors for years.
Right. So. And Nomi, how much of the budget is covered by dues or people coming to the museum? I would think that most of it is your fundraising outside of the dues.
That is correct. Yeah. Right. So many, many members of the public think that admission makes up most of any museum's income, and it's actually a very small percentage. The museum on its own, through fundraisers and earned revenue, is usually about half of our operating budget. We do have an endowment, which is a great cushion for the museum and does help support our annual budget. But we strive to raise about $100,000 a year through our fundraisers, and that's sometimes a combination of smaller fundraisers. So like tomorrow we're having Whales and Nails, which is, you know, a small fundraiser for the museum. The levels of giving change from year to year. But we're certainly seeing, you know, I don't judge the museum's success solely based on the dollars and support that we bring in. Our most important marker for me is community engagement. And, you know, post-COVID, we're seeing higher levels. I think there's a renewed appreciation for the museum as a local gem. We're seeing higher attendance. It's possible that, you know, when we all had to take staycations, it made people realize there's a really cool place in your own backyard. So it's wonderful seeing people come in the door again, and it's wonderful having busy days here.
It's really two separate issues. One is you want to get the most engagement you can, but you also have to be able to fund it. So it's a two-step
Correct.
Approach. You know, I would think that one is mostly in your ballpark, and the other's in Anthony's and the board, which you have a great board, and they do a great job in you know, leading you in the fundraising efforts that you do.
Thank you.
Yeah, they seem to do very well.
Thank you, Howard.
And yeah. I just wanted to ask you ask both of you the question. If you could have changed things, something that you could have done during the COVID pandemic relating to the museum, is there anything you would have changed as the way that you reacted to it?
That's a very good question. Let me think for a minute.
I'll tell you this, Howard. One thing that's good is one permanent, not permanent change, semi-permanent change. So our board meetings have all gone virtual, so we've got to bring them back into the museum. I think that one thing again on the it's you know, that's a good question. It's hard to answer. I think making a I don't know. You got to answer. It was so hard.
Well, maybe you were so perfect that you did everything right and didn't have to change a thing.
It was like, you know how it was in the beginning. You're just taking it almost like day by day and saying, well, all right, well, maybe next week we'll be open.
Yeah.
We'll be back to normal. Like I started to say at the beginning, to go back a little bit before COVID, and to anticipate, you know, how we could stay in touch with the community and vital to the community. You know, I'm big on the virtual part of it, but virtually and online, that would be something that, as much as we had, that would have been a great thing to, a bit of comfort to fall back on a lot of that. And like I said, our social media presence and everything was very, very good, and I think that sustained us in terms of interest in the museum. Not sure what we could have changed during, you know, you felt like your hands were so tied, you know?
Yeah, I think building on what Anthony said, I think I would, if I could go back, I would change my mental status and the incredible fear that there was early on. Right. But really, like, and I remember lying right. awake at night thinking, tomorrow I have to lay staff off because how am I going to do this? And if I cut anyone's hours, I'm cutting my own hours. Now, how am I going to do that? And I would lay awake right. and think, wait, tomorrow, okay, that's next week. But then, you know, there was a light at the end of the tunnel. Sources came in. We never had to close. We never had to cut anyone's hours, and we stayed as a team. And I'm very proud of that. And I'm proud of our resilience. And I'm proud of how we were able, you know, once that fear started to recede, to think outside the box, keep the museum running. And, you know, when you look back, it's, you know, of course, it's much different, but when you're in it. But I think I would just tell myself it's, you know, the just to cut down the fear level. And then there's also the fear of getting it, you know, and then you get it and you think you're going to die. And then it ends up being, it's okay. And that it was almost a relief after I got it because now I wasn't scared anymore. Life is okay.
Can whales get COVID? Whales didn't get COVID. Right?
They have other diseases, but not this.
Not COVID. They didn't have
not,
to not this
yet.
Okay. Not yet. Not that we know of.
Not that you know. Have you tried to, like, what would you say is your, you say your community. What's the community for the museum and how far geographically do you try to outreach to? Is it just the Huntington area? Is it all of?
Sure. No. Anthony, do you want to take this one or do you want me to jump in?
Well, I think, you know what, normally we'll tell you, we get visitors from like Germany, we get people from Europe a lot. I think we'll have people who come, there's a lot of people who obviously come to New York and visit, but we do get people from, we see a lot of people coming from Europe. We do have interest, again, if you look online, from people kind of hitting most of the country. It is predominantly people in the Northeast, not just Huntington. It's not just as small as that. Smaller, like other museums, like let's say the other whaling museums. I don't want to cast aspersions on other whaling museums, but they might have smaller communities. But we see a lot of people from the Northeast in general. So let's say going down to New Jersey and up to Massachusetts area.
Well, where would you say that you're a place for destination that people go, you know what, today I'm going to go to the Whaling Museum in Cold Spring Harbor? What geographic region would you say that people would make you as a destination? Don't tell me they're coming from Germany. Say, gee, I got to come to Cold Spring Harbor to see the Whaling Museum. I think they're going to other things.
right after they see the Brandenburg Gate, they're like, next, Cold Spring Harbor. I think Howard is most. Yeah, I agree. I think it's probably most people who kind of gravitate to the North Shore from or the South Shore or from Manhattan, from the city. You know, who come out to the North Shore, they explore, you know, going out to the vineyards, but there's a lot of people who come out to Huntington for the restaurants and everything. And you see a lot of people from the South Shore of the island and people from like the city, anybody in Nassau County, Queens and Manhattan.
Okay. Right.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
We tend to see that most people come within a 30 to 45 minute drive. Longer than that, you know, like from Queens, Cold Spring Harbor tends to be a lovely day trip. But our primary audience are adults and children within that little half an hour bubble around us. And we do serve a multi-generational demographic. What's interesting, Howard, is that during COVID, we planned and installed a special exhibition that explores the African-American experience in whaling history. That's part of our strategic plan to highlight stories for historically marginalized audiences. And this year, since that new exhibition is up, we are seeing more visitors of color come to the museum, which is very encouraging. And we're happy to see and serve a more diversified audience. Mm,
that's interesting. Anyway, I think our time is about up. It really went quickly. We all learned a lot about whaling, I think. But if someone wants to learn more about whaling, Naomi, why don't you tell them exactly where the museum is, and if they have questions, how to contact you about to find out more information, or if they want to give donations, maybe you can give them the website.
Sure. So we're located on Main Street in Cold Spring Harbor. Our email, our website, pardon me, is cshwhalingmuseum.org. Most of our collection is digitized, so you can see some of our wonderful treasures online. We are open throughout the year. We're open Tuesday through Sunday in the summer season. And the museum really comes to life when there's a program or event, so I encourage our listeners to visit the museum's events page and see what's going on. My email address is director@cshwhalingmuseum.org. You can also contact me through the museum staff page. I would love to be a resource and answer any questions. I'd love to greet you at the museum. There's also lovely eateries in Cold Spring Harbor. It's a very picturesque, quaint town. We do walking tours in case you're interested in learning more about the area, but we do hope people will make time to visit.
Well, thank you, Nomi and Anthony. I think it's been very educational, interesting, and I hope anyone who has a chance to visit the museum, it's really a great place. My grandkids love going there. And
I thank you for your participation.
You, and I'll speak to you soon at the museum. Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks, Howard. Take care.